Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Devendra Hardwar.
So how you doing, Devendra?
Doing okay. Just, really busy as always, but, trekking along before all the madness of the iPhone stuff starts.
Oh, boy. And yeah. That's due to come we've heard now, like, a kind of a, not official from Apple, but official from, basically Verizon blocked out vacations for their employees.
Yeah. Not official from Verizon, just a word from a Verizon insider says that they blocked out, from September 21st and until like what the 31st, I think.
Right. So we're a lot of thinking that's going to be when it is. Anyway, on this week's show, we're going to be talking about a pioneer in cloud gaming that faces bankruptcy, massive layoffs, and major restructuring. And disappointment in the stock market for Facebook and record-breaking success for Apple. But before we do, let's talk a little bit about some of the other headlines going on. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been granted political asylum by the Ecuadorian government after taking refuge in its London embassy on June 19th. The asylum decision follows a UK Supreme Court ruling in May authorizing Assange's extradition to Sweden to face questioning over alleged sexual crimes. It seems unlikely that the UK will allow Assange safe passage out of the country. Police remain on the doorstep of the Ecuadorian embassy, poised to arrest the WikiLeaks founder should he leave the building. However, the embassy remains the soil of Ecuador, and British police have no jurisdiction to enter what is de facto Ecuadorian territory without the permission of the ambassador, despite the fact that they've made veiled threats to that effect. Now, I bring this up because it's not necessarily tech news, but Julian Assange is a prominent figure in the tech industry because of WikiLeaks in general. So it falls kind of under the purview of our duty to report it. What was your opinion on this?
It's interesting how far Ecuador is going to protect him. Honestly, and I've talked about this a bit before, I always found it kind of fishy that these sex charges came about right after he started leaking some pretty sensitive information. It all seemed to coincide a little too quickly, so I don't know the specifics of the case, and I'm not sure what went down in Sweden, but it feels fishy to me, just as a gut reaction. So it'll be interesting to see where the story goes, and if he gets out of there, I'd be fascinated to figure out how. Like, the only thing I can think of is, like, you know, in The Dark Knight with the Skyhook thing, Batman just comes in and, like, flies him away.
Well, I mean, there's such a thing called a diplomatic pouch, and a diplomatic pouch basically is the protected property of the whatever consulate owns it. And that, from what I understand, that diplomatic pouch can be of any sort of size. It's just the concept of a diplomatic pouch.
Right, but can it be a vehicle?
That's a good question. And I've heard about that. I've heard about that idea itself, that the vehicle itself can be considered protected property, but the moment that Assange steps out of that vehicle to get onto a plane, for example, just that space between the car
and the
plane.
Jump from the doorstep to the vehicle, then jump from the vehicle to the plane.
Right. Unless he packs himself in some sort of diplomatic crate, and that crate is loaded on board the plane. That would be some... I'd actually like to... You know, I'd be curious about engineering some sort of way to get him...
This sounds like a Breaking Bad situation. I'm not sure if you've been keeping up, Andy, but whole season has been basically various heist schemes and all sorts of weird things that they've had to figure out.
I have. Oh, it's been crazy. That whole situation with the not to give too many spoilers, but the situation with the underground tanks and the train was just insane.
That was good. That was good stuff.
Okay, moving on here. Twitter announced last Thursday changes to its API that will limit how often a third-party client can access Twitter. The company announced that most third-party services will be limited to 60 calls per hour, essentially the number of tweets a user can send to Twitter using an app like Tweetbot or Twitterific. The number is bumped up to 720 per hour for tweet display, profile views, user lookup, and user search. The limits are set on Twitter's API means that once the limit is hit on third-party software like Echophone or a curation service like Storify, communication between the app and Twitter are cut off until the limit is reset, in this case, each hour. Additionally, third-party clients will be limited to 100,000 users. Anything above that number will require permission to expand from Twitter. The more popular apps that have over 100,000 users will be able to expand up to 200% of its current user base. Twitter says the limits are well above what the average user needs. However, developers feel like they've been hit by a ton of bricks. Developers feel jilted because they've invested time and resources into developing apps for Twitter, only to have the company change the rules of the game. On the other hand, Twitter is a business that needs to make a profit. While it's a logical move, the company isn't scoring any popularity points. What do you think about this, Devendra?
It's kind of a difficult situation. On the one hand, I understand that Twitter needs to monetize like crazy. They right. still don't have like a legitimate business model. The whole ad thing hasn't, you know, it's not fully as profitable as they would have liked. And they're trying to figure it out. What I think is really interesting is that, you know, as Facebook has slowly, you know, wanted to become more like Twitter with the newsfeed and everything, it's funny that, you know, Twitter is becoming a lot like Facebook. Like, they're totally trying to lock users down into their own clients and their own website. And even though they still play better with third-party developers than Facebook may, it's just interesting. Like, it's like a weird stabilization almost. A couple of years ago, like on the Symbiotic podcast, we were talking about like how unwise it is to build your business around somebody else's right. service and APIs, and this is kind of that. Like, if you take that risk, yeah, this could happen. This was a specter over your business yep. for a very long time. So I understand why people are pissed. I guess it's a shame too. Like, we've talked about Dalton Cadwell and what he's trying to do
with AppDynamic.
I think it comes down to like the people who really wanted Twitter to be an essential part of the internet, like an internet service, sure. almost like email or you know, HTTP in general, like something that's a core part of the internet. And unfortunately, Twitter is not that. Twitter is a business, right. needs to figure out how to make money, and they're gonna lock things down so that you're only using their stuff. The only problem with this is that I hope innovation around these third-party Twitter clients doesn't go away. It sounds like there's some weird arcane rules, like third parties only get a certain amount of tokens for users mm-hmm. or something. People who already have apps now, like Tweetbot, a couple others, like they have a pretty large amount, so they're not going to be hitting any limits soon. But for new developers, it's really going to discourage developers right. from building new things for the Twitter ecosystem. And Twitter itself, just, I'd feel less bad about this if Twitter wasn't so crappy about developing its own tools. Mm-hmm. The only good Twitter app is the Twitter app for the iPhone, and that's because that was from Tweety. That's right. Tweety rebranded. But Twitter on Android sucks. There's no Twitter tablet version for Android. Running an Android tablet right now is a horrific experience for Twitter. I've been testing out the Galaxy Note 10.1. Even on the Nexus 7, mm-hmm. it's just not that great. And you look at like Mac software, the Twitter Mac applications is okay, but they still don't know what to do with TweetDeck. And it's been such a pain. It's my favorite Windows client, but it's still ugly. It still hasn't really been improved. And on TweetDeck on Mac has been kind of stripped down in a weird and strange way. So I don't know. I'd feel less bad about this if Twitter showed that they could actually support the people who use their apps. But clearly they're pushing people to use the website, which is what I think the number was like 75% of users, Twitter users, just go through the website. So the people complaining right now are the, you know, a small slice of mm-hmm. people who actually use other Twitter apps.
You think that's because it's easier to serve ads on the website as it is than it is through these third-party services?
It could be that. It could be that it's just, in terms of Twitter's actual architecture, it may be easier to push updates to people who have, you know, the website open rather than a client that's pulling, that's making all these API calls. I'm not sure if that's any different. I'm not a developer, so don't, you know, don't yell at me if I'm wrong. But it seems like there's a lot more freedom for them to just like plug in media and ads and whatever in the website. And it also like it makes more sense for them to spend time developing that since that's where most of their users are. So like it's a shame. I mean, I understand Twitter has to kind of focus on where everyone is, but for a company that's so almost mainstream at this point and so well-funded, they should really have a clearer idea about what they're building and why, and this shouldn't have been such a surprise to the developers. So
right.
It's just a shame.
Right. It seems like the larger lesson here is those that ignore history are doomed to repeat it. And it seems mm-hmm. like a lot of these major services like this are kind of like crack dealers. Like they let you have the first free tastes for a while, but eventually it comes time to pay the piper. And I can think of very few services like Twitter or Facebook where they haven't eventually locked down their API and pissed off third party developers in this way. Right.
But I mean, Twitter was unique among other services. Like, one of the reasons I fell in love with it initially was this was the promise of, like, a whole new mm-hmm, medium, mm-hmm. right? It's the next email. It's something between IM and email that, you know, you can sit there and watch the entire world can just have conversations. There is something that feels inherently open about that. So I guess it's kind of... It's a jarring reminder that Twitter is actually a business
when they do things like email. Because email is a protocol.
It's a protocol, right?
Yeah, it's not a company that's owned by one. You know, it's not owned by one concern like Twitter is. So it's a dangerous lesson. But I don't know what to see. You know, developers. It's like I said. We've certainly talked about this before on the Drill Down, even before the symbiotic podcast came onto the Drill Down. We've had many discussions about the fact that that when you buy into services like this, you have to basically, you know, you're subject to their whims and their changes. So
right, pretty much. And you know, when it comes to AppNet, we talked about it last week, but right. I still don't think that's the solution either.
No, like the
only way to have done this was to actually have either, I don't know, like a higher education institution or a government agency or somebody, so just a nonprofit, somebody who's building something for the greater good of the internet,
right,
and not charging for it, which is what app.net is doing, and not serving ads for it, which is what Twitter is going to be doing, and who knows how else they're going to monetize us. We kind of missed I don't know, the possibility of that next piece of internet. I actually wonder if we'll ever see another like truly open internet standard like email or like HTTP or like, you know, what else, IRC?
I agree. I don't think we will, like, because somebody's going to be want to fund it, want to be behind it. So
and the only company I can think of is like Google, because they've pushed things like SPDY, which is their like, you know, faster HTTP protocol or something. Mm-hmm. But even then, like, even if they fully open it up to the world and let everybody have it, I don't know. People may still feel weird that it's coming from Google. They may feel like it's specifically, you know, engineered for Google services. It's we're past a point where people are building nice, fun stuff for the open internet.
All right, let's move on here. Apple likes to trumpet its walled garden approach to software installations on its iOS operating system as creating a secure platform, but no platform is bug-free. French iOS security researcher Pod2G has discovered a serious security hole, one that has existed on the device since its introduction in 2007. The report indicates that spoofing of the reply to number that is displayed when an iPhone user views an SMS is easily done. That means the viewer of the text message might believe the message they're reading comes from a person other than the actual sender. Just as with a spoofed email in which any reply would go to an alternative address, Any replies, such as a malicious text message, could be routed to a different phone number without your knowledge. Pod2G's analysis of the problem seems to indicate that the issue may not necessarily be isolated to the iOS platform. It depends, it would seem, on the implementation of the SMS client. Apple's response is, their representative said that Apple takes security very seriously when using iMessage. Instead of SMS, addresses are verified, which protects against these kind of spoofing attacks. One of the limitations of SMS is it allows messages to be sent with spoofed addresses to any phone, so we urge customers to be extremely careful if they're directed to an unknown website or address over SMS. So I like the way that they kind of took this opportunity to push their service over SMS. Nice on their part. So this is interesting. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's completely indigenous to Apple, to iOS, but it's interesting that there is this mm-hmm. potential danger out there.
It's more about the implementation of SMS in iOS. So Apple actually responded to this. I asked them for a comment when this mm-hmm. first happened last week, or earlier this week, actually. They finally responded like yesterday or the day before. And they basically said, this affects all phones and you should use iMessage instead.
Right.
Yeah, if this doesn't affect iMessage, because that's purely Apple's thing and that's a pure data service. It doesn't go over SMS at all. But the problem here is that you can implement SMS properly so that it shows both the original sender address and the reply to address. And, I'm not sure if it's very difficult, but it's something that Apple never did. So this flaw has been around for a while, and Pod2G says that potentially other hackers may have, been aware of it and using it for some time. Apple's response seems kind of, I don't know, disingenuous.
Yeah.
Or just because it's you can definitely look at other phone platforms where this is implemented in a proper way. And I don't know, this feels just like typical Apple when they can never admit
yes.
when they do something wrong and then the next update will fix it.
That's
and
exactly
never say anything
what I'm
about
thinking.
It. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking when I first heard this. Ugh. Is that
and that, that
this
that's
is
the
so
sort
typical.
Of thing. That's what really annoys me about Apple, right? It's like the really snotty kid in high school who is so smart and
right.
never does anything wrong. When they actually do something wrong, they'll never admit it, and they'll
right.
just they'll completely deny it. So it's a shame. Hope this gets fixed soon.
But the only time that I can think of when they actually did sort of admit that they were wrong was the whole antenna.
Barely, though. Like yeah. it took them, I think, a month.
Yeah.
And then at first, remember this the famous Steve Jobs thing
right.
is that
you're
holding it wrong. the first response is always defensive or like
right.
you're stupid user, you stupid users,
right.
you're doing it all wrong. Do it the Apple way. And I hate that. I hate that mentality. And the fact
yeah.
here is where it's specifically a software implementation. I don't know how they can argue themselves out of it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, their argument would clearly be that it's not indigenous to Apple. It's the fault of the format of the protocol itself, and of course, as you said, as they've said, if you just use iMessage, everything will be fine.
Yeah.
So
yeah. So I wonder if like they knew this was an issue and just didn't choose to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
That seems a little too cynical. I don't know.
I think that's it for our headlines before we get into our main topics. So before we do that, let's take a second here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com. And for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called Shada, Doctor Who, The Lost Adventure. And this is written by Douglas Adams and Gareth Roberts. Actually, it's based on a Douglas Adams screenplay that he wrote
mm-hmm.
for the original Doctor Who series, and Gareth Roberts has adapted that screenplay and expanded it into a larger sort of novel narrative. And this particular, let me read a little bit about the description of this. The Doctor's old friend and fellow Time Lord Professor Chronotis has retired to Cambridge University where nobody will notice if he lives for centuries, but now he needs help from the Doctor, Romana, and K-9. When he left Gallifrey, he took with him a few little souvenirs, most of them harmless, but one of them is extremely dangerous. The Worshipful and Ancient Law of Gallifrey isn't a book for time tots. It's one of the artifacts dating from the dark days of Rassilon. It must not be allowed to fall into wrong hands. The sinister Skagra most definitely has the wrong hands. He wants the book. He wants to discover the truth behind Shaeda, and he wants the doctor's mind. And this particular audible recording is actually read by the actress who played Romana on the series, and I'm drawing a blank on the name, and I can't bring up the internet to find
Layla
it.
Layla Ward?
Layla Ward, thank you very much. Yeah, she was the original Layla, I mean the original Romana during the Doctor's run, which I think was the Doctor number 4, which was the... I can't remember his name either. God, I'm drawing a blank on all these names.
Yeah, this is beyond me. So.
The one with the big hat and the colorful scarf.
Yeah, I got nothing. I didn't really watch Doctor Who until the reboot. So,
But it's a great opportunity to hear a lost adventure, especially one that was written by Douglas Adams, who did write a few of screenplays back in the day for those early episodes of Doctor Who, like the Fourth Doctor era. That book can be yours, or you can choose from any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles. And all you need to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook, or your choice of any others, plus the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. Okay, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about OnLive and all of the ups and downs that have been going on with that company during the week. So we're going to play a little music, and when we come back, we're going to talk about that. So take a listen to this, and come on back.
Swinging in the backyard, pull up in your fast car, whistling my name. Open up a beer and you say get over here and play a video game. I'm in his favorite sundress, watching me get undressed, take a body downtown. I say you the bestest, leaning for a big kiss, put his favorite perfume on, go play a video game. It's you, it's you, it's all for you. Everything I do, I tell you all the time. Heaven is a place on earth with you. Tell me all the things you wanna do. I heard that you like the bad girls, honey. Is that true? It's better than I ever even knew. They say that the world.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Devinder Hardawar, and let's talk about OnLive. So, just to summarize, and this comes from reports from the San Jose Mercury News and from your own VentureBeat, Devinder, from Dean's work there, Dean Takahashi.
Cool.
Streaming gaming company OnLive has disclosed that it went through a bankruptcy alternative late last week as part of the proceeding called an Assignment for the Benefit of Creditors, or ABC, plan. All previous online shareholders, including its employees and founder Steve Perlman, lost their stakes in the company, and OnLive laid off all of its employees, the company said in a statement released Sunday. The newly formed company that acquired OnLive's assets will operate under the OnLive name, continue to offer its services and operate its game service, and has offered jobs to nearly half of the company's former employees. The events started on Friday morning when Steve Perlman announced that all 200 or so OnLive employees were being laid off. The company's assets were being transferred to a new owner, and some of the people would be hired back. Any equity held by the employees in the old organization was essentially lost. The OnLive game services continue to operate through the transition. Customers who bought or rented games from OnLive before its insolvency process will retain rights and access to those games after it, they said. So that's good for me because I had a couple of OnLive games through the service. As of Friday, Lauder Partners, a venture capital firm run by Gary Lauder, provided the initial financing for the newly restructured company. OnLive confirmed for now, Lauder is the only investor in the new OnLive, but the company expects to have more investors soon, according to a spokesperson. Perlman, CEO of the old OnLive, received no compensation for the acquisition of OnLive's assets and is receiving no cash compensation for the new company, according to a statement. He doesn't yet have a title or contract with the new OnLive, Lauder said in an email, adding that more urgent issues such as employee compensation took precedent over resolving Perlman's status. Now, this whole situation really kind of breaks my heart because I really felt like OnLive was a forerunner in the whole not only game streaming, online game streaming, but the whole concept of app streaming in general. Like, they were just starting to break into that kind of realm where they were going to go beyond serving games and starting to serve apps. You know, they had an iOS app that would serve Windows virtual console through their system. And I thought that they really were breaking through with the promise of what could be a whole new realm of services. And they were that at the forefront of that. And since then, they've had other there have been other competitors in this space.
Gaikai, which Sony bought, mm-hmm. I think, a couple months ago.
And Otoy, that's the other one.
Yes.
Gaikai and Otoy. Now, I really felt like the big lesson that I think that OnLive has learned is that essentially, you know, I think they thought that they had this moat, you know, where no one else could touch what they do. But unfortunately, they didn't. They didn't build their company up to the point that they could float on that moat.
This sounds like Dig Syndrome almost.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you think you have this mm-hmm. or basically it's more like what was going on with Netflix, where you have this service and you think you're the only person that can provide the service, but unfortunately you can't build up the business enough, you can't build up customers enough to take advantage of this to get mm-hmm. any sort of platform away from your competitors, and then you have all these other competitors who are like, you know, we can do that too.
Yeah, well, Netflix hasn't had, like, I mean, there was the slight loss of some subscribers when they gave up on the whole disc thing and then kind of brought it back. It got really confusing. But they never had a huge loss. Like, they've been still trucking strong, even though they're maybe not making as much money as people wanted. One thing Dean points out, Dean Takahashi, Adventure Beat, it seems like OnLive, maybe like Dig and maybe like a lot of other companies, they thought they were worth a lot more mm-hmm. than they initially were. I think the valuation was, I don't know, $1.8 billion or something. It was a very high amount that maybe investors didn't actually think or potential buyers didn't actually think was true. And then Sony bought Gaikai for $380 million, which is a much lower amount. Mm-hmm. So once that happened, the potential for OnLive to even be a billion-dollar company kind of evaporated. And the San Jose Mercury News is reporting tonight that they were in debt up to $30 to $40 million. So there's a lot of stuff going on. They didn't scale properly, or maybe they scaled too much and just couldn't afford it. So
I mean, that's some of the reports that I'd heard is that they had bought a lot of servers. Mm-hmm. They were ready to take on a good, you know, they could withstand the load of multiple customers, concurrent customers, but they just didn't have enough concurrent customers to essentially to be able to justify what the servers were costing them.
Right, right. It's a good lesson for any startup or any technology company. You know, don't build the hardware when you don't even have the customers.
Right.
You know, you don't build for, well, I mean, you do want to build for the future,
right,
but you don't want to go bankrupt building for the future, that's for sure.
Right. So what do you think is going to come of OnLive? I mean, this is they've rolled over into a new company with the same name and and one in major investor right now, and they pretty much, pardon my French, fucked over about half of their previous employees.
Pretty much everybody. I mean, even the new people who got rehired they don't have the equity in the old company that they did. But I think OnLive's statement was even Steve Perlman, the CEO, didn't get back his equity.
Right.
So it's, I don't know, I'm sure he's going to get something, you know, a big part of this new company. Mm-hmm. But if anything, this is a reputation tarnisher, right?
Yeah.
OnLive was such a new and cutting edge service that any little disruption, you know, a service disruption, some sort of weird hack would have been a problem. But this is like, this is the worst of the worst. This could potentially, you know, I don't know, it could hold back the whole idea of streaming games in general. So I don't know, but maybe after this happened, it'll be a cheaper purchase for somebody like Microsoft, because that was one of the rumors that I've been hearing,
mm-hmm.
or one of the deals I thought would have made a lot of sense, is that with Sony buying Gaikai, it seems pretty likely that the next PlayStation would have some sort of game streaming technology built in, and people have been saying the same thing for the next Xbox.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have made sense for for Microsoft to buy OnLive. Now the company is so troubled, now there's so much, I don't know, junk
bad
behind
blood.
It that I don't even think Microsoft would touch them.
Yeah, not only that, but this whole issue has created like a ripple effect with HTC. Did you hear about this? HTC,
yep.
Has to,
because they invested in them,
right?
So.
They invested them to the tune of $40 million, and they have to take a loss on that investment.
Pretty much, yeah, the entire $40 million, because all that money's gone. Everything that I have had before is gone. As an aside, what the hell were you thinking, HTC? This is the same company that invested $300 million in Beats Audio. Freaking idiots. Like, they're just pouring money, and they're not making much money either. Like, I have to look at their most recent earnings, but they've been kind of in a crummy spot since Samsung took over the Android crown and has become the world's most the world's top phone maker. HTC doesn't have much money, but they keep making really stupid investments. Beats eventually bought back half of that, half of the shares HTC bought, so they paid HTC $150 million back, but HTC still lost $4 million.
Right.
With that whole fiasco. So what the hell? Just stop, really.
Other backers of OnLive include Warner Brothers, Autodesk, Maverick Capital, AT&T, British Telecom, amongst others. Like, I can almost understand HTC's investment, because OnLive seem like such a sure thing. You know?
Sure.
It, like I said, this is what's really heartbreaking, is because I really do believe, like, I was a OnLive's biggest skeptic until I tried it. You know, I couldn't understand how it was even possible to have seamless, smooth, low latency game streaming and not feel like any sort of lag or anything, any hit. And then I tried it, and I'm like, I was sold the first time that I tried it. They made me a believer. It worked as advertised. You know, there was very little sort of loss of fidelity or resolution in streaming the games over the service. And I've seen it work, you know, on multiple platforms. I've seen it work on my Mac, on my Windows, on laptops, on desktop. Like, the technology works, and it's just a shame to see such a company with so much potential being hit in this manner.
Yeah, I think maybe they just started buying into their own hype a bit too much, like you were saying, too. They thought maybe they were the only ones that could do this. They had great technology. It worked, but they didn't have the users. And yeah, I don't know where... Like, clearly there were some bad decisions made at some point. Maybe when they should have been taking things a bit cautiously, they decided to spend a lot more and build up an infrastructure that would have been nice for a buyer. Too bad that buyer never came.
Right. You know what this feels to me like is a little bit like web TV. Like web TV, those guys were ahead of the curve. Like they were doing set-top box content.
But the infrastructure was never there for web TV. I mean, that thing was plagued. It didn't even work for its core like use, right? It barely worked for that.
Right. Right. But in concept, I mean, they had a great concept.
A great concept, but you know, at least OnLive executed. And that's something so many companies can't do. They executed, but they fumbled, you know, running to the finish line. You know, I don't know what metaphor you could use for this, but they had everything. You know, they had the money. Well, they had the money initially. They had a lot of funding. And they had the technology. They had the smart people.
Right.
Did not have the users.
If only they'd
partnered.
Probably
you should fix that problem before you do anything else.
I think if only they'd partnered with somebody like Steam, like Valve, I think the thing is maybe it's ahead of its time, but I really do feel like I have a strong instinct that online app streaming is the wave of the future, that we're going to be seeing a lot more of this, and it's a shame, like. OnLive was like they were the bleeding edge. You know, there's an old saying that if you're two steps ahead of everybody else, you're a martyr. And if you're one step ahead of everyone else, you're a genius. You're a success. And I think OnLive was two steps ahead of everybody else, unfortunately.
Yeah. And that's actually a good metaphor for Apple and Microsoft sometimes too. Mm-hmm.
I think that's it for that section of the show. We're just zipping through this. Let's take another little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the highs and lows of recent tech stock, and whether that portends any sort of concern for the tech market in general. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Winners and losers, turn the pages of my life. We're beggars and choosers, with all the struggles and the strife. I got no reason to turn my head and look the other way. We're good and we're evil, which one will I?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm here with Devinder Hardwar. Let's talk about the recent results of some of the major tech companies out there. I'm going to start with Facebook here. And this comes courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. Facebook shares sank 6.3% to a record low on last Thursday, falling below $20 a share on a day when some early investors were allowed to unload their stakes, adding further pressure on the beaten down stock. Rules expired Thursday that had restricted some early investors from selling down their stakes after Facebook's initial public offering. More than 271 million Facebook shares became eligible for sale Thursday, though holders could also choose to keep some or all of their stakes. Any additional shares would add to the 421 million already in circulation. But meanwhile, and this comes courtesy of The Guardian, Apple has become the most valuable company of all time, surpassing a record set by Microsoft in 1999. Shares hit a high of $664.75 per share in Monday morning trading, valuing the company at more than $619 billion. The price topped the $618.9 billion Microsoft achieved in December of 1999. Shares have risen again on rumors that Apple is planning to launch a smaller version of its top-selling iPad and is close to making a new push in the TV market. And TechCrunch has corrected that a little bit by saying that that doesn't account for inflation. That when you account for inflation, that Microsoft is still the number one, the most valuable company in the history of the world, at about $856 billion in constant dollars, $235 billion more than Apple's current market cap. Nonetheless, Apple's run has been incredible, but it hasn't been enough to take the crown as the most valuable company in the history of the world. But I was just looking at these two companies and looking at Facebook, companies like Facebook, Groupon, Zynga, these companies have all severely underperformed since their initial IPO launch. And it makes me wonder, you know, is this the kind of forebearer to an, is this what the this next tech bubble is going to look like, as opposed to like a huge crash like we did, like we had in the first tech bubble? Is this
instead of a pop, it seems more like a fizzle, or something, or just a slow deflation,
or were these companies, all of these companies, just severely overvalued? Was Facebook overvalued? Is this the actual value of Facebook as it stands?
I mean, I'm not a financial guy or stock guy or anything, but I think it is interesting that, you know, Zynga was so, was so touted and had so much publicity behind it. Groupon was touted as like the fastest growing company ever because they rose in revenue and valuations pretty quickly, or valuation at least. But I think like maybe there's too much of a perception or the need to find something new and cool. Mm-hmm. And especially if we see something that works great initially, we may give it too much credit. And this sort of happened to OnLive too. It's really easy to look at something and say, oh, this is going to change the world, this is going to be everything, and assume that that's going to be around forever. But I mean, even you look at Apple, like Apple has went through some really troubling times. Its stock was in trouble quite a few times. But it's come back really strong because it's proven itself as a really strong and persistent player in the computing industry. All these young companies, like they really don't have much of a shot. Like unless if they make one mistake, you know, their stocks will tank. And but even then, like I feel like a lot of them want to be the next big thing, and they almost feel like they have the entitlement to be that thing. I think Facebook, especially, I don't think Facebook is doing that much good. And yet, it's sort of become the de facto social identity for the internet.
You know, in my opinion, I think maybe everyone was really sort of chomping at the bit for Facebook's to see a tremendous success out of Facebook, especially, you know, in its IPO launch. And I think that we were all we had all kind of mismanaged our expectation in Facebook's success compared to how we as a culture had valued Facebook as a service. And I think there's a huge difference between, you know, what a company is worth to you personally and what it may be worth to the market. And I think that's essentially what we've seen here with Facebook. And I know it's certainly what we've seen. I think Groupon and Zynga are two different stories altogether. I think Groupon and Zynga are the same story, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. They're a very similar story, yeah. In unsustainable that, growth.
Right.
Yeah. Lots of, I don't know, lofty ambitions and lots of fantasy.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
And once again, these are companies that thought they had a moat and did not. And what I say by that, of course, some of you may not be familiar with the term having a moat in tech, in, as it relates to tech, is that you have this service that you feel you have the indigenous kind of lock on that no one else can touch. And Groupon, I think we saw immediately that Groupon was the first company that did not, that thought they had a moat and didn't, when we saw other services like basically Google, Amazon, they all had their own individual sort of coupon, daily coupon service that proved that Groupon's wasn't the only game in town. And then Zynga, I think Zynga, their situation is that they relied too much on Facebook. And, you know, there are other companies out there that do casual games, and they can't sort of hold their own without that relationship, that symbiotic relationship with Facebook.
They didn't figure out anything in particular. Yeah, they were in the right place at the right time. They learned, I guess, how to tap into the super addictive nature of certain types of games. But really, I mean, this has been happening since Diablo. Like, video game addiction is pretty easy to replicate if you strip things down to the very, very bare minimum. But Zynga had, they were probably one of the first to have that integrated social function because of the Facebook partnership, and that let it explode. Yeah. And that's why, like, Zynga has never created a game that's actually, I think, an enjoyable game to play. You know, it's, they don't care about that. They care about click, 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 click. Right. Don't think, share with your friends, microtransactions. Yeah.
Right. And I think that the only thing that makes me think that maybe this isn't like the forerunner to a tech fizzle or a tech bubble is Apple's success, and I think that they're, but I don't think that they're necessarily an outlier or a lone wolf. I mean, I think you could say the same for Google and Microsoft as well. I mean, those companies have been fairly stable. Do you have to be of a level of Apple or Microsoft or Google to weather a fizzling tech performance like Facebook, Zynga, and Groupon have had?
I don't know if it's about size, but there's a certain, wisdom to those companies because they've built services that are, they're useful, and that, you know, they've been around for a while too. Even Google, like back in the day, the reason it didn't face much of the whole .com bubble bursting was that it had like a useful, legitimate service that was not hype. It was real. You know, and I think a lot of Groupon's stuff was hype. There was a lot of controversy about how real their earnings were, what their books were like. We're hearing like the same stuff before, or at least when it came to Facebook doling out its stock to investors and people selling off the stock now after the lockout period ended. And Zynga's kind of the same way. So I think it's not that hard to see when a company is not offering you something real, something substantive. But then again, even when something real is there, like with OnLive, like it can still fall apart for other reasons.
All right. I think that might be it, unless there was anything else that you wanted to bring up this week, Devendra.
I reviewed the Galaxy Note 10.1 Adventure Beat. It's not a good tablet.
Oh.
It is such a disappointment. And you know what's really sad is that dealing with all of these Android fanboys, they just come out of the woodwork when you review a product like this. Mm-hmm. A product that I'm pretty sure they're never going to buy. These people are never going to spend $500 on it, but they're going to defend it to death.
Because of the
platform.
They'll
never use it, but they'll defend it for whatever reason.
I want to know basically how it works as a drawing tablet.
The pen stuff is fine. I'm not a good artist, but it actually had some really interesting pressure sensitivity, and it felt a lot more realistic than they call it the S Pen. It felt a lot more realistic than the stylus on the Galaxy Note smartphone. They use some better Wacom technology. It's a really interesting idea, and I think for certain people it could be really useful, but the problem is it's weirdly slow for a device that has so much hardware. You know, they have this feature that lets you multitask and run two apps side by side, which is kind of cool. You know, kind of cool because I generally think tablets suck at productivity because you can only do one thing at a time. But the problem is this key feature is really slow, despite the fact that this tablet has a 1.4 gigahertz quad core processor and one of the fastest processors out now, and 2 gigs of RAM. You know, this thing has the specs of a PC, and it can barely hold two tiny apps side by side. And these aren't even full sized Android apps; these are like smaller versions of apps or something. It's just really sad. The slowdown really bothered me. It doesn't function very well as like just a plain tablet. So even though you have some nice pen functionality, using it as a tablet is just freaking boring and freaking just slow and dull. And it's a shame because the Nexus 7 is what, $200 performs faster, feels better, actually feels more high quality too. Samsung really loves plastic, and man, does that get annoying.
Oh, that's really sad.
This thing feels so flimsy. It's a shame.
Oh, that's a shame. I was really kind of hoping that that would be sort of a nice portable alternative to the Cintiq, which is like upwards of $2,000.
Yeah. The people who really want to do this will buy the Cintiq.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is just not a good enough solution for anybody. I wouldn't wish this tablet on anyone.
That's a strong words.
For $500, like really, you gotta offer, something. Especially the Nexus 7 is so good. I'm not sure have you had time to play with it, Andy?
I haven't. No.
It's good. It's fast. It's cheap, and it feels. I know it feels substantive in a way that's really nice too. It's the latest version of Android. It could be that the TouchWiz improvement Samsung made to Android 4.0 on the Galaxy Note, it feels like I'm stepping back in time. I'm using a less polished, less cohesive operating system. So all that stuff is just really annoying. And then when you get down to it, Android doesn't even really have many tablet apps. So it's like, why are you buying an Android tablet?
Right.
You don't need to do this to yourself. You can buy an iPad for the same price, or buy a Nexus 7 for $200, or just don't buy a tablet. You don't need it.
Do you think we'll ever see a contender to the iPad that is on its level?
You mean like 10 inches and the same thing? I mean, the problem is there's no ecosystem level of iOS. Like Apple, one of the smart things Apple did when the iPad came out is that they really pushed developers to make iPad applications and to push the tablet idea. It's something that they cared about. They really catered to it. When Android tablets started coming out, Google didn't even really know it was happening. Like they had no control. Samsung's first tablets, the Galaxy Tab, the 7-inch. I have one sitting here. It doesn't even run like a tablet version of Android. It's just straight up Android 2.3. Blown up for a bigger screen. That's it. So none of the apps were even built for that screen specifically. There were no real tablet apps. And it took Google a year to officially bring Android to tablets. Then it took Google another year to actually make it look good. So it's like Google just is not paying attention to tablets. It just seems like they don't even care about this whole onslaught. They want the numbers. They want the market share that, you know, putting Android on smartphones and dumb phones is giving them.
That's a shame because Google actually has the muscle to really put some power behind this. I mean, they've got the people, they've got
we've made this argument before, right? Like Google has all the pieces. Like they're a whole bunch of engineers. They're really smart.
Yeah.
And then they create something like the Nexus Q, which tore apart because it's so stupid. And because of the way those people think, those engineers and the people who think maybe in terms of raw specs and stuff, they think it'll make it a good product. And they never ended up releasing that. And all the people who pre-ordered a Nexus Q, they're going to get one for free whenever it actually ships. Don't feel jealous of them. What are you going to do with that thing?
Right, exactly. What purpose does a device like that really serve?
Yeah. So I don't know. It's I'm almost feeling existential when it comes to Android these days. It's like, what do you need this for? What purpose is this? Why do you exist? And I ask that question for pretty much every single Android tablet. The Nexus 7 is the only one that's been able to like give me a good answer.
Well, I might just check out the Nexus 7. See what, but yeah, no, I'm pretty satisfied with as I am with the iPad that I have. So
or wait for the smaller iPad eventually. I guess I don't know.
All right, okay, Devendra, where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra. I podcast about movies, TV, and other fun stuff at /film.com, and I write about technology at venturebeat.com every day. Everything else I do is at devendra.org.
Terrific. As for me, you can find me at mrbabyman.com, gplus.to/mrbabyman. Maybe we'll be getting a Google Plus /MrBabyman URL sometime soon. I know Google's gearing up to release. I know that they've started to roll out personalized URLs to some verified users, so maybe it'll come around to me eventually. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Go to Geeks of Doom. We're right there in the upper right-hand corner on the sidebar. Our show is on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices. Find it at your app store at stitcher.com, facebook.com/thedrilldown, twitter.com/thedrilldown. Sign up at, I don't have to do that anymore. if you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.